For the week of September 7th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 248, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And inside the new U2 album, I'm Michael Giltz.
Hey, you know, you're giving us like a, you know, a copyright violation right now.
No, not because they gave it away for free.
That's true, but only until October 13th. So, yeah, so I just got done watching the new Apple product announcement, which, you know, Michael, every time I watch these and they bring out like a rock star at the end of these product announcements, I think
it's kind of sad.
Why would any rock star want to do this? It's like, let's spend an hour and a half talking about an iPod or a watch. And then you bring out U2, probably the most successful rock band working today, if not ever. And they're like the 50th most important thing at the event behind a watch. And
well, they had a fun little announcement at the end, though.
So right, exactly. And then I was like, why would they do this? And then, of course, they go off and talk to Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, and they're talking to him. And they say, oh, you know, a lot of people have faulted us for not having an album in 5 years. But, you know, we've made an album. And they are giving away their album now via iTunes, which has over 500 million subscribers. So I wonder if that's going to make them number one on the Billboard charts.
Well, no, it doesn't count because you it doesn't count as a sale.
And that was a softball, Michael. That's exactly why I said that, because I know that and you know that. But I wonder, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, if everybody understands that.
Well, we'll get to them in Big Deal, Big Whoop. What else will people hear when they listen to the show today?
Are you serious?
Which they're doing right now.
That's true. But did you include that already?
Yeah, it's in Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Unbelievable. I had no... Wow, okay. Well, I certainly did not know that. On this week's show, we're actually going to be joined by Richard Verrier, a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. He covers the ins and outs of the entertainment industry. Richard will join us to talk about how the state of California is planning to triple tax subsidies for film and TV productions to $330 million annually. This comes during a time when there is an increasing debate over the value of film tax incentives and whether they actually create new jobs. We also will continue our discussion about the summer's box office because, well, actually, just Michael
won't let go.
Yeah, Michael loves math, frankly, and he just won't stop crunching the numbers on this year's releases. Also, the media won't stop talking about how the industry is doomed, 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 we tell you, because this year's summer movie season was off by about 15%. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week right up until this very moment, apparently. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at the worldwide box office, not just North America. We'll get our figures from RentTrak. We have a link in the show notes. We also pull information from Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. The number one movie around the world is Lucy. Scarlett Johansson's action film from director-producer Luc Besson. It grossed another $27 million worldwide. It passed the $300 million mark. It cost $40 million to make, and there will be a Lucy 2.
You think so?
How could there not be? I mean, I didn't see the film. Maybe she dies at the end. It doesn't matter. They'll figure something out.
They'll do a prequel.
That's right. Before she becomes smart and lethal? I don't think so. At number two around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the number one film in North America. There was a little concern in North America. It might gross less than $10 million, which would have been the first time in 2 years that the number one film in the country had not grossed into the eight-figure digit range. But it did, and it grossed $21 million worldwide. It's at $586 million in counting. We expect it to hit $700 million when all is said and done. At number three around the world is The Expendables 3, another $18 million. It's at $124 million worldwide. We're crossing our fingers to see if this movie can get to $300 million, or really $270 million. That would triple its budget and put it in the clear-cut success category. If a movie triples its budget, a big-budget film that's released by a good-sized studio, you can pretty safely assume it's made its money back, right?
Yeah, generally. It's usually
triple
three or four.
The budget.
Yeah,
you can't look at a movie that's a small film. You don't know how much they spend on marketing versus the budget and all that sort of stuff. So it gets a little trickier. But for a big studio, you triple your budget, you're going to be making money. There's pretty much no doubt about it.
Well, here in North America, it made $1.8 million, The Expendables 3. But it opened in China and went on overseas. It made $17 million. Thank you, China. I'm sure Sylvester Stallone is very happy you know, that the film is doing well there.
That's right. And it's only in 34 territories, so it's got quite a ways to go. At number four, another film we're waiting to see the final results on, that's Hercules. Even though people have written their obits for this summer's box office. A couple of movies are still out there making a lot of money. Hercules is one of them. That made another $17 million. It's just about to cross the $200 million mark. It needs to reach $300 million in order to be profitable. I think that will do it as well. At number five is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. No question, this is a big hit. $643 million worldwide. Right behind that is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, a reboot of that franchise. That passed $300 million worldwide. It made $15 million over the weekend. It needs to get to about $375. I don't think there's any question that it will do that. So that's yet another successful film from this summer. At number seven is Into the Storm, that wacky mid-budget movie about natural disasters. That grossed $13 million, and that's at $110 million worldwide. But it was kind of pricey, wasn't it? I mean, relatively speaking. It cost like $50 million to make, so it's not in the black yet.
No, it's not in the black yet, and I think they were hoping for something bigger, but then they probably saw the finished product and said, gee, what do we do with this? Let's stick it in summer.
August.
Yes.
And number eight is If I Stay, a teen weepy. That passed the $50 million mark. It's just started to open up overseas pretty well. And number nine is Let's Be Cops. That's at $85 million. And number 10, here's a film we haven't spoken about yet. It just opened up. It's called Taza, The High Rollers 2. It's a South Korean crime caper film. Sort of feels like a Ocean's 11 if you look at the trailer. And it's a sequel to a movie from 2006. It's about people who are very good looking, but gambling in the underground crime gambling world of South Korea. And it's based on a manhwa, which is a South Korean comic book, comic strip. I guess that's sort of like their version of the manga. So it's called a manhwa. I believe I'm pronouncing it properly. And that movie opened up just in South Korea, I believe, and it made $8 million on its opening weekend. Very similarly is a Chinese romantic drama. This is called But Always, and it opened up in a couple territories, eight territories, and it made $7 million.
Well, there was another South Korean film on the charts this week, wasn't there?
Way down at number 16 is My Brilliant Life.
Yes.
This movie grossed $4 million, so it had a modest opening. I don't know what its budget was or anything like that, but it's a weepy about two parents who have a son with a terrible, rare genetic illness that makes him age prematurely, and the kid is trying to write the story of his parents' romance so he can give it to them on his 18th birthday, assuming he lives that long. I think tears will be shed. It's based on a novel called My Palpitating Life. So I think it was a good idea to change the name when they made it a movie into My Brilliant Life. That sounds a lot more appealing.
Well, are you sure it wasn't actually based on the movie Jack, starring Robin Williams and directed by Francis Ford Coppola?
I've tried to forget that film. I believe I actually saw it.
I think a lot of people tried to forget that film.
In North America, a couple things of note. One is Boyhood, the Richard Linklater film, which is certainly one of the most critically acclaimed films of the year. That passed $20 million in North America. So great success for that movie.
And it's on under 1,000 screens, so it's doing quite well for itself. $4 million movie that has been playing for weeks and continues to do well.
That's right. It's got legs.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, and you know, speaking of weepies, I was just looking at the numbers for Fault in Our Stars. $300 million. It's a $12 million movie. It made $300 million worldwide.
Yes, it's a huge success story from the summer. Again, they can't kill them twice, so I don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to make a lot of movies from all the other John Green novels. So that's already happening, of course. But yeah, they'd love to make a sequel to that if they could. Not easy to do. But Forrest Gump, you know, if you can't make money off new movies, you re-release old ones. They put Forrest Gump out in IMAX theaters. Did you go to this? Did you get an invite? I got an invite, and I was like, why would I want to see Forrest Gump in IMAX?
I got an invite, but I only opened it after the screening. And I thought to myself, am I getting email from 1994? Like, how did this happen? And then I saw, you know, the movie listings for the weekend, and Forrest Gump was totally in the movie listings. And even in the Apple product announcement, they did this moment with the little Apple Watch there where they said, show me the movie times, and up came Forrest Gump. And I just thought,
why would they pick that movie of all films?
Well, no, it just was in the list of movies that were showing nearby. It just seemed weird. Guardians of the Galaxy, and right next to it, Forrest Gump. It made no sense.
No, it's no reason not to re-release classic films. My complaint is releasing it in IMAX,
yes,
which is a terrible way to see most movies. And if it's not shot in IMAX, there's no damn point to it. And most IMAX screens are FOMAX, so they don't even count as IMAX screens, genuinely. So you're really wasting your money, and nobody did. It made about $381,000. They had it on 300 screens, so it made about $1,000 per screen. So some people went to see it. It's a beloved classic, I guess, though I don't think it's aged well, though I shouldn't say that about Seen Again, but certainly its reputation has fallen since its spectacular success when it came out. I mean, it was an Oscar winner, huge box office hit. But again, this is a movie, I think I put Gone with the Wind on IMAX, Casablanca. I mean, what's the point?
Ooh, those are good ideas. Hold on, let me just write those down. What was it you said? Gone with the Wind, right? Yeah, I'm gonna note to self. Okay.
So, Sperling, you were doing other stories at Cellular Junkie and elsewhere talking about the summer box office. People liked our headline from last week where we said, everything you've learned about the summer box office is wrong.
Right. So I'm putting a story together. And so to do that, I'm actually reaching out to the heads of distribution at some of the studios just to find out, you know, how important really is North America.
And what did Chris Aronson, the head of worldwide distribution at Fox, what did he say about the North American market?
Well, he said North America is the biggest and most important territory in the world. If you fail here, it makes it more difficult to succeed internationally. In the domestic market, one cannot take a campaign designed for another territory and adapt it to work here. Here, one starts from scratch and has to make it work or else.
Well, that's certainly in general true. North America is the biggest market. That won't be true in 5 years, but it is right now. And you make a lot more money with a successful film in North America. And that's going to be true for a long time because the country that's going to pass it is the market of China. And
that's
in China,
correct.
You don't make anywhere near as much money per dollar as you do in North America, right?
That is correct. And let's face it, you know, studios are run by people. And not robots. And with that comes ego. And so I can't tell you the number of times I've been at international conferences and the representatives from, let's say, Latin America for a specific studio will be sitting in the audience of a panel discussion where their counterparts, their American counterparts who work in Los Angeles or New York, are up on stage on a panel and they will stand up and ask a question of their own exec, you know, basically people who work for the same company about something. Well, gee, can we do X, Y, or Z in the industry? And you think, well, why? Don't you just, I don't know, send them an email or give them a call? And it's because everything really stems from on the studio level, everything stems from North America.
Well, that's where the power is and the money is and the green light is, right?
Exactly. And so when the marketing campaign doesn't work here, it's certainly not going to be very helpful overseas. And likewise, it's probably not going to go the other way.
Well, but it's probably not the marketing campaign. It's probably the movie.
And
they say it's the marketing campaign. They mean the movie.
Yes. And I asked him, I said, you know, are there still other ancillary revenue streams that are tied to North American growth? So that is both sometimes domestic television licensing and international television licensing. They're all tied to domestic growth in North America, as is, by the way, sometimes a box office take. So they'll do a North American gross ratio. So if you make $300 million, then you get 63% of box office. But if you make $250 million, then it's only 58% of box office.
The sliding scale.
Sliding scale, yes. Thank you for actually saying that in two words, what took me an entire sentence to do. But I asked him that, and he said, yes, it is true. They still tie things to North American box office, other revenue streams.
Right, but when you talk about like marketing, I know they tweak marketing campaigns sometimes, or sometimes a word arises or a title has a different meaning, something like that.
Yes.
But 90% of the time, most movies are pretty much marketed the same way worldwide, I would think. You got Transformers. You're going to show pictures of buildings blowing up, right? Robot machines smashing each other, buildings blowing up, and that's it. It doesn't change radically, I wouldn't think.
No. And now that, you know, and I think your point, I don't want to make it for you, but I believe your point is, look, yes, North America is important. Yes, you have to make a lot of money here. And yes, you can't bomb here, as we're seeing with Expendables 3, and still hope to have this profitable movie necessarily.
Well, sure you can. That's exactly what we're saying, that Expendables 3 may well make triple its budget worldwide, and when all is said and done, be a profitable film, even though it's not going to be a big success.
Right, and I suppose I should have thrown in the word always there. You can't always expect to earn
make it back up. No,
yes.
Of course not. If you bomb anywhere, it's not going to help you anywhere else.
Right.
And North America has a bigger impact.
Correct. Yes. But what?
Oh, the point you were going to make. You were trying to make my point for me.
I was going to make your point for you, which is, okay, since they're holding on to the rights, the studios are holding on to the rights all over the world now, they're not selling it off necessarily. They're not pulling a Weinstein company or a Miramax where they're selling it off territory by territory. They own it in China. They own it in Japan. They own it in the UK and France and Germany. So you know what? When it makes money there, that money is going into their pockets. So at the end of the day, when they start seeing how much money a specific movie made, They put all that money, and I know they don't do this literally, but they look at the entire gross, worldwide gross.
Right. Exactly.
So it's how much money.
All things the same. You'd rather make your dollar in North America than in China.
Right.
You're gonna make, but nonetheless, you make a lot of money in the UK, including ancillary markets. You make a lot of money in Germany. You make good money in Russia. You make a lot of money in other, you know, it's everywhere around the world. You know, yes, North America is the biggest market, but there are a lot of other markets. There's like 70 territories, 90 territories, right?
Easily, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea, again, I'm sure California is the biggest market in North America. I bet you get more bang for your buck, make more money off the movie, make more money off ancillary in California than you do even in Florida or New York or Texas. Maybe they're close, but you certainly make more per dollar than you do in Oklahoma or Wyoming or Illinois. That's not to put down the Oklahoma, Wyoming, Illinois. It's just a fact. But you don't look at the box office in California. You look at the box office in North America.
I think you would look. I think you would look at the box office in California.
Well, it's always useful. But the main point is when you add up how much a movie made, you don't go look at just California. And you don't look at just North America. You look at the world.
Well, I'm sure somebody will point out, well, in North America, all the theaters will give the same, roughly, the same percentage of box office, where in Russia, the same thing, they'll give the same percentage of box office. And that's why you look at it country by country, because the percentages are different and the cultures are different.
Right, but the studio knows how much it made and it doesn't care ultimately. If it pulls in $600 million net, comes back to them from all these other countries, that's $600 million. And it's always useful to know, hey, it was a big hit in France, but didn't do well in Turkey. But nonetheless, whether it's 35% from this country and 38% from that country and 30% from another, you know, it all adds up.
Yeah, and I will take $600 million. I don't care whether, I'll take it.
And the big thing I'd like to say from this summer to last summer is that I got pulled into a sucker's argument, and that was comparing the summer of 2014 to the summer of 2013. And that is a fool's errand. They will, every week when the box office comes out, they compare this weekend to this weekend last year. And they say, oh, box office is down 10%. It's up 17%. It's down 14%. It's up 22%. It doesn't matter.
Well,
right?
And
it
you
really
and I,
doesn't matter. What matters is what movie did you release and how much money did it make? That's all that matters. Comparing weekend to weekend from one year to the next is utterly pointless.
I would agree with that when you're looking at weekend, you know, year to year. Absolutely. I think, again, always look at long term.
Right.
Look
but
at
you're
trends.
Comparing this weekend to last weekend. We're comparing this summer to last summer. This summer, they released 12 big films. Last summer, they released 23 big films. That cost $75 million or more to make. They spent an extra $900 million on the movies they released last summer. And people go, oh, this summer's a disaster. No, almost every movie that we released this summer made money. Virtually all of them. The only one that's a clear failure is Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise. We had 12 big movies, and 10 of them, 9 of them, I should say, are clear-cut success stories.
Well,
one is
and
a flop,
I would say that
and
Edge
two
of
them are still on the bubble that may make money. Those are Hercules and Expendables 3. They may end up in the black as well. Last summer, half the movies were flops. The list of flops was endless. And yet everybody is saying this summer is a disaster compared to last summer. Go to our website, look at our show notes. You can see the list of movies that came out last summer. These are the big bets that studios made. These are movies that cost $75 million or more to make. And we show all the movies, what their budget is, at least as far as reported, and how much they ended up making worldwide, and how much they made in North America. You know, are they flops or are they successes? They had 23 big bets last year. Half of them were flops. This year, you had 12 big bets. Almost every single one of them made money. How is that a bad summer?
Because it's down 15%. Well, you know, and Chris Aronson, then this is a little preview of the article to come, because I'm still talking to a few executives. He says, we shouldn't be worrying about declining box office now. It's pretty easy to explain this summer's down box office. A dearth of family animated product and too many unsatisfying sequels that managed to make up ground overseas. In the case of Fox movies, our sequels were both well-received by critics as well as audiences, which is why they were successful. Box office is cyclical and is healthy if you give the people what they want. However, escalating ticket prices coupled with a dearth of well-received pictures spells trouble for the future of box office returns. Which, now mind you, keep in mind, Mr. Aronson knows he's talking to somebody who is going to write a story that is going to be read by movie theater owners. So that is his way of reaching out to them and saying, gee guys, maybe you shouldn't
keep
be raising your ticket
prices.
Yeah. You want to know why box office is down? You keep raising prices. Now mind you, he also had two hit films, X-Men and Planet of the Apes, as he referenced, and he's also referencing two sequels. Remember, he's not talking about Godzilla sequels, both Spider-Man, whatever it is now, Spider-Man 2 and Transformers, which, okay, Transformers didn't do as well in North America as other Transformers movies have. It still made a ton of money worldwide.
Right. And of course, the markets matter. It made $300 million plus in China, and a lot less of that comes back to the studio. So that is really important when you look at the movie. When they look at Transformers, they say, oh boy, we're falling off a cliff in terms of, you know, profitability. But it's still a very profitable film and made $1 billion worldwide. You got to work hard to make that into a failure. But the point is, if you look at our show notes, comparing, it does matter where you make your money. And if you look at two movies from last summer that are sort of on the bubble in profitability, one is Pacific Rim and the other is Star Trek Into Darkness. Both of them have sequels in the works, so obviously they made money, or they made enough money that the studios feel comfortable going forward. But if you look at them and we break it down, Star Trek made a lot more money in North America, whereas Pacific Rim did not. And so Star Trek is a lot more profitable than that other film.
That is correct. Yeah, because when you think about it, if you're going by the roughly 25% licensing fee for premium or certain television rights for Star Trek, and it makes $228 million in North America, well, all of a sudden you're licensing that for $22.8 million for one window. So just, you know, $228 million, if they get half of that, let's call it $114 million, throw an extra $22 million onto that.
And so what you're saying is there's a general contract that sort of is out there for big cable channels or premium cable channels. They buy the rights to show a movie and they agree to pay you not a flat fee, but a fee based on the total box office of the film in North America, typically 25%.
Yeah, output deals. And we could really get into, well, the output deal allows them to go to the bank and borrow money, but we're not going to get that complicated. It's not worth it. It's fascinating if you're interested in that kind of thing. But these output deals, and by the way, that's why, like, on Hulu or Netflix, all of a sudden, movies will disappear. You'll have no idea why. Well, they're in another window now.
Yeah.
Another licensing window.
And they're all very profitable for the studio, and that's why they're not going away anytime soon for big budget movies.
That's true.
But 4DX, is that going anywhere?
Yes, it's going a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right and a little bit forward and a little bit backwards. And then it's going to spray you in the face with some mist and some fog.
So 4DX is these silly movie theater rooms where you get like surround sound and sense around, and they shake your seat and they spray mist on you and do all sorts of things to make the movie even more exciting.
Yeah, it's immersive technology. Yes.
And there's one screen in North America.
Well, okay, 4DX. Yes, there's one screen.
Other companies do this.
MediaMation is a company that is probably most known for their work in theme parks and museums.
It's like when you go into one of those rides where you're looking at a video screen and feel like you're on a roller coaster or something, or going through space like in Star Wars. It's that idea.
Exactly. Full disclosure, I have ongoing conversations with MediaMation. D-Box is another company out of Canada, I believe, that does the same thing.
But how many screens are there in North America that do this sort of nonsense?
I would say 500. And you know,
500?
Yeah, give or take. Like, let's say
commercial movie runs of commercial movies. I'm not talking about in theme parks. I'm talking about you go to see Transformers and they offer it in whatever you want to call this, 4D.
You know, I don't know. I know D-Box has quite a few. They have the huge head start.
I've never even heard of a theater offering it. Is there any in New York? I don't think so.
Oh, I'm sure there are.
You've gone to one? Really? Like what? I've never heard of it. I've been to every big theater. I've seen every premium thing they offer. I've never heard anybody saying, here, get sprayed in the face with mist.
Yeah.
I've never heard of anyone who went to it.
Well,
I've never heard of it.
D-Box doesn't do that, okay? D-Box is just...
I've never heard of anybody offering anything other than IMAX. IMAX 3D. That's as fancy as I've heard. I've never heard of nobody claiming this new sense around theme park ride type experience at a movie. I don't know of that in New York anywhere. Have you been to one in L.A.?
I've been to... Let's put it this way. I have been to theaters that offer it.
Uh-huh.
I personally have chosen not to see the movie that way.
Well, Variety had an article strictly about 4DX, which is a particular brand, I guess,
and
is what you're saying.
And 4DX is actually a... by the way, you could go to South Cove Stadium 12 in, Bayonne, New Jersey to see Guardians.
That's not in New York State.
Okay, fine.
I'll find another one.
Let me look up...
So Variety had an article about this, and it was very lame, I must say. Brett Lang wrote it. I'm sure this thing read like a paid ad. It was very lame. There's one theater in America that offers it, and they make it sound like it's a big success story. And at the end, they mention, oh yeah, nobody else has committed to doing one yet.
FYI, it just goes to show you how valuable a PR rep is, because this is a company, CJ Entertainment, which has a lot of money. Okay, 4DX is made by a Korean company that does that owns movie theaters, that owns, you know, basically they own a distribution and movie theater, so they own both sides. They're now getting into this immersive technology where they're making the immersive technology and selling it all over the world. Well,
there are 112 4D screens in 20 countries. That's what they say. In 20 countries, they got a total of 112 screens. They've been doing it since 2009, but there are no real facts in this story about trends in sales. Like for screens that have been around for more than a year, how are they doing? Are they holding steady? Are people still going to it? Or is it a fad that, you know, fades away? And are they being less, you know, I want to know what the long-term trend is, and I don't get an idea of that from this. All I know is there's one screen in America offering this 4DX, and they're like, oh, it's a hit. Now, they claim something really weird here. They claim that this theater, this one screen, which is, where the heck is it? I don't even know. I don't even know if it says in this article. They claim that it gets a 63% occupancy rate. And they say most theaters operate at 10 to 15% occupancy. Most movie theaters, most weeks, 85 to 90% of their seats go unsold. That sounded awfully weird to me.
Yes,
am I just wrong because I don't realize how many times a day they have screenings where there's nobody there and it's really just the evening and the weekends?
Yes. It's actually, by the way, it's 130 movie theaters for D-Box alone in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom, Japan, Hong Kong, the Netherlands, Australia.
But not in New York State.
No, there's like one or two. I don't know I'm still trying to find. I don't know about New York City.
Never heard of it. Never known anyone who's gone to it or wants to.
Well, you know, it's funny because
it's like the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Who the hell is paying for this?
Well, you know, because of the ongoing conversations that I mentioned previously, I have been asking around about this. And you know who this really is for? This is for kids. They all say, look, it's not for me. I don't, you know, when I ask adults, they have no interest in it, much like yourself.
To wear glasses?
Well, it depends if it's a 3D movie or not, right?
Okay.
And very few adults have interest in it. However, their kids, on the other hand, it's an amusement park ride. That would be amazing. That would be great. And I think, wow, okay, so that's who's interested in this.
Well, not really. I mean, I know kids who thought 3D was great at first, and they got sick of wearing the glasses.
Yeah, no, you don't have to.
Most movies, it's stupid.
You know, the funny thing is I talked to a distribution executive who's on the tech side of things, and because there are so many different companies that are doing this now, they have to test all of the, you know, do quality assurance on all of the different technologies. So they said, you know, after the fifth immersive seat experience, motion chair, basically, they said, my butt was hurting. Because they had to watch a particular movie like seven times.
Well, I'm going to call it 4D, and I'm going to say 4D or whatever you want to call this, motion experience. This is not the future of cinema.
Well,
it's the future of theme park rides, and it's not a novelty that any theater should waste their money on and plunk in and think, oh, this is way we'll scrape out a couple extra bucks from the theater goers.
I think it works for certain movies.
It doesn't.
I've had a couple movies where it's definitely
worked. It's stupid. Unless the director wants it and crafts it and chooses it, you're just adding. It's like going to a movie and they add a pop song soundtrack to the film. Oh, you'll like it even better. We're going to add in pop songs. Well, it's not part of the movie.
What are you talking about? The number one album.
I'm saying pop songs that weren't in the film.
Oh,
like they just start playing music. Oh, you'll like it better if I play some Motown. No, I won't. You'll like it better if your seat moves. No, I won't. That's not the movie. You show the movie the way the director made it. He didn't design the movie to be seen with seats shaking.
Well,
it's stupid. It's add-on bullshit that has nothing to do with the film.
Thank you for making me edit.
Ah. Sorry about that. You want that experience? Go to a theme park. And it works great. I've done it. But it's not a movie. You know what is a movie? A pigeon sat on a branch reflecting on existence. Now that's the name of a film. And I can't wait to see that in 4D.
I think you just really just put a whole bunch of words together that popped into your head and just strung them together.
That is the film that won the top prize at Venice. It's by Swedish director Roy Anderson. It won the Golden Lion. He's a terrific director, certainly not a mainstream director at all.
No, not at all.
I've seen two of his films at Cannes, Songs from the Second Floor, and what was the other one called? I can't remember, but...
No, literally, that was the name of the film. It was called, what was the other one called? I can't remember. That was the name of the film.
Is that what the name of the film?
No, I'm kidding.
It might be, but he's a terrifically bold, unconventional director. I think he made commercials for many years.
Yes.
But he's just a really unique filmmaker, very dry, droll sense of humor, and just an incredible talent. His new movie, he makes very few, but his new film opened up at Venice. It won the top prize. I can't wait to see it. It will never be seen in 3D. His other film, by the way, is You the Living. So he made Songs from the Second Floor in 2000, You the Living in 2007, and now his new film, A Pigeon Sat on a Branch, Reflecting on Existence.
And he will reflect on his next film, if all things are
equal.
Hold
true, 2021.
2021, right, correct.
Exactly.
And Andrei Konchalovsky won the Silver Lion for Best Director for The Postman's White Knights. It's a documentary-style narrative set in a small Russian lake town. And everybody seemed to love the cinematography and the storytelling in that film.
That's right. You've got Venice, you've got Telluride, and now you've got Toronto, which is ongoing right now. There's some interesting movies coming out with good reviews for performances, mostly, I'd say. Those seem to be the standout thing. Not that they're saying this or that film is great, but this or that performance is really good. So there's been a lot of back and forth between Toronto, and they're trying to say, hey, you can't show your movie at Telluride and elsewhere in Venice and expect us to show it. So they've been trying to establish themselves a little bit more.
They actually put the brakes on the whole Venice thing. They said, no, North American premiere.
So they skipped Venice. All right.
Yeah, because they knew that, you know what, they can't stop people from trying to premiere in Venice and Toronto literally one week after the other. But what they really want to do is stop Telluride from stealing all of the big premieres by having it screen literally the week ahead of time.
And yet, so few people go to Telluride that, as the trade said, what did it matter?
It doesn't.
All you're doing is looking like a bully and stupid and making life difficult for smaller films, etc. So
the way I look look at Telluride as a press junket, because it's filled with press, and that's, they're all going to see it and talk up the movies that are good, so that when it comes to you in Toronto,
you know that you need to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, so that's film festival stuff going on, and it's a big whoop, because what matters ultimately is the movie and when we get to see it in the theater.
Oh, well, then if that's a big whoop, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Speaking of overhyped, our first story, I am sure as we are speaking, Michael, is being overhyped. Probably by the likes of us, in fact. This is how timely we are. This happened less than an hour ago.
I've already downloaded the album.
You have?
Yeah, that's what I was playing at the beginning of the show.
Oh my gosh, because, you know, as Tim Cook was on stage counting down, I was literally on iTunes refreshing the homepage, trying to see if, like, it would go live as he said he was going to push the button and send the album out for free. And it didn't
happen. Well, tell him to read the story.
Okay, well, U2 is giving away their new album. Okay, it's called Songs of Innocence. The entire album will be available for free to the 500 million people registered on iTunes worldwide.
Well, they'll have it forever. It's not like they get to stream it for a couple weeks. They own it.
That's true. The exclusivity lasts through October 13th, when everyone else, if there actually is anyone else left, well, they can pay for it at that time after the 13th. This announcement was part of the Apple Day of announcements surrounding the new iPhone and Apple Watch and Apple Pay services. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, ultimately. And like we've been saying for years, the music industry has gone back to the way it was in the 50s or the 60s. You put out an album, you put out an EP, you put out a single, it didn't matter. You made your money touring. And the album was sort of just a loss leader or a thing to say, hey, I got some new music, come see me live. That's the way it was in the old days. You didn't sell 4, 5, 10, 20 million copies of an album. You just put them out, and you just put them out whenever you wanted to. And that just kept promoting your band and your brand and kept people wanting to come see you. And now U2 is not out of the game yet. I mean, maybe Mariah Carey should have given away her last album for free, because U2's last album actually sold 5 million copies worldwide. No Line on the Horizon is the name of that album. And that's certainly well down from their career peaks, but that's still nothing to sniff at. You figure like $8 a copy or five, you know, that's $25-$40 million, right?
Yes.
Sure. But who cares? That's among the lowest total since they broke through worldwide. And on the other hand, compared to their album sales, their last tour, U2 360, that included 110 shows. It took place over 2 years. It sold out every single venue, every single one, and they grossed about $750 million worldwide.
And by the way, I would say each one of those shows, not counting the PA fee, the personal appearance fee, probably cost about $1 million to put on. So forget paying the band, just the equipment. The load in, the load out, the technology, the
well, golly, that's $110 million.
Exactly,
that's great. If you make a movie for $110 million and it grosses $750 million, you're doing great.
Precisely.
Right. No, it's a very expensive show to mount. They had days off between each venue because it took so long to put it in place. But they one of the highest grossing tours of all time, $750 million. That's where they make their money. So why not give away your album?
Exactly.
You know, why not? And I already did it. But think of the backroom stuff that Apple must have done, because it did crash briefly, somebody said. I think it was the Times. But it's back up. As soon as I saw it, I went into iTunes. I loaded it up and said, oh, you've already got the album. You've already purchased it. Just press this button and it will start downloading. And I did, and it downloaded to my home computer in about, 2 minutes.
On next week's show, we'll tell you how many people downloaded the album for free.
Yeah, they certainly will tell us. But imagine what they had to do technically to be ready for that crush of people.
Well, I can tell you that they did not do the same thing with their live stream. Because of the announcement. Because they actually, and this is Apple, when the live stream started, you couldn't actually access it. And when you could access it, it was only for like a couple seconds, and it had Chinese...
I wonder why they couldn't figure that out. They know how many people are going to be trying to tune in.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess, I think I sent out on, it was on Twitter that I said, I wonder what the productivity decline throughout the world right now is, because nobody's working. They're all watching the live stream to see what the Apple iWatch or Apple Watch looks like.
I think when all is said and done a year from now, probably the most substantial thing. Well, I mean, the Apple Watch may in fact be a big category. It's already a big market. My sister has one of those little bands you put on your wrist and counts your steps and all that. So I'm sure that will be a big success. I shouldn't say this, but I think probably the most impactful thing will be the Apple Pay.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that's really going to change things.
Now, to that point, and I'm literally going to do a drive-by on this.
All right.
We purposefully have chosen not to discuss the iCloud photo leak. We have purposefully decided not to do that. So if you want...
Just because it's up in the... It's been covered well. I don't know what we can add. And it's not clear what exactly happened. So we don't have much to say. In general, don't tweet when you're drunk. Don't post pictures of yourself. Anyway, even if it wasn't broken into an iCloud, I never put any of my information on the iCloud. Not that I don't trust Apple. I just don't want my information out there. I have a backup hard drive. But like, as far as my phone numbers, my photos, my videos, I don't put that stuff online.
Yeah, why in the cloud? In the cloud, everybody can see it. Where's the like iBunker or the iAnthole? Where is the stuff that's underground where nobody can see
it? Got nothing to do with Apple though. I don't do it for any service. I don't like to have my music in the cloud. I want to own everything, and I want to have a copy of it on my own personal hard drive, because it just doesn't. I really should be more encrypted, frankly. I'd like to do that. I'd like to switch to more encrypted email and more strongly encrypted phone, but I haven't done it yet.
Oh, well. Wow, this first story just, we got totally derailed.
Keep going.
Okay, well, our next story with longtime exec Stacy Snyder leaving for Fox, and I don't know whether they're to call them 21st Century Fox or 20th Century Fox anymore.
Their name is 21st Century Fox.
All right, well,
In 80 years, you'll have to say 22nd Century Fox.
Which is
Deal
why I
it.
Wouldn't have changed the name in the first place. But in any case... Stacy Snyder is leaving for Fox. Steven Spielberg has chosen Michael Wright as the new head of his shingle, DreamWorks, because Stacy Snyder used to be the head of it. You used to call DreamWorks a mini-major, but its slate has been severely reduced in both numbers and overall budget for years now. That's, of course, a major reason Snyder left. There wasn't so much to do anymore. Mind you, just overseeing Spielberg's projects as director and producer is a full-time job. One small example is the TV series Falling Skies. As a Turner exec, Wright worked with Spielberg on the Noah Wiley starring drama and earned his respect, though ironically, he won't be overseeing the DreamWorks TV division. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
Okay.
I mean, unless they're going to announce, more budget and more big movies, they're down to just doing $30, $40, $50 million movies, mid-budget, low-budget flicks, and whatever Spielberg wants to do. I'd be proud to work with Spielberg and involved in producing his films, like Kennedy and Marshall were for so many years. It is a full-time job. But as far as getting to make a slate of films happen, it doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And they didn't even bother saying, oh, no, we're going to be doing live. We're going to be gearing up. No, they said nothing about, big future plans. So it sounds like, I mean, who doesn't want to work with Spielberg? But still, it's not like running a studio.
Yeah, the big question here is, will Reliance, who is one of their big backers, give them more money to make more movies?
I don't know if there's any desire for them to make more movies. They didn't even pretend they had a desire right now.
Well, and their deal, I think, is up in 2016. Their output deal with, or their distribution deal with Disney will be, over in 2016. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with DreamWorks. Now, our next story is, I guess it's about a movie, but not really. It's about Broadway. Lots of Broadway news. I don't know. Okay. Hey, you know what? Do you think this show would be better if they put a Motown sound? No, just kidding.
I do.
Okay. It'll be better with motion chairs. Lots of Broadway news is out over the past week as the theater season enters its slowest month. Of course, that month being September. It's not that slow, actually, with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick beginning previews for their new comedy, It's Only a Play. Literally, that's the name of the show. It's Only a Play. It's a revival of the Terrence McNally work that also stars F. Murray Abraham, Stockard Channing, and Megan Mullally. Basically, a bunch of hacks. The show immediately entered the Million Dollar Club, proving everyone still loves to see Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick together. Of course, they did the producers a couple years back. But the big news is on upcoming shows. A musical version of Dr. Zhivago is coming to Broadway next spring, taking the theater currently occupied by Cinderella, which finally announced a closing date. That leaves King Kong as a bridesmaid. That's right, King Kong, the musical, which is fine since the Australian musical is, you know, this is King Kong's coming out of Australia. It's being completely overhauled and isn't nearly ready for its close-up. Hopefully they actually overhaul it into a completely different show, and one not named King Kong or having anything to do with King Kong. And for sheer oddity, Larry David of Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm is coming to Broadway. He wrote and will star in Fish in the Dark, a comedy co-starring Rosie Perez, among others. No one saw that coming. Is all this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, you know, upcoming shows coming to Broadway. Of course they are. They always are. I'm a little surprised by King Kong, though. I always thought that was slated for the theater occupied by Spider-Man. That's the biggest space on Broadway. I thought that was the only space that could accommodate King Kong. It's now open and available, but Kong isn't ready. So I think what happened is, you know, they would have had that theater, but, you know, they're just not remotely ready. So now that space has to take some other show. I don't know what they're going to take. And now King Kong is waiting for another space. But they're going to wait for Dr. Zhivago to come and go. They don't get that theater until Dr. Zhivago leaves. So if it's a big hit, they're without a theater show completely. They're going to have to wait around for another theater. And this points out the big problem of Broadway, which is shows are running too long. There are no theaters available. That's why the Schuberts are building a new Broadway house from scratch. I think it's on 45th or 46th Street, and it hasn't happened, a brand new Broadway house from scratch, since like 1989 or something like that. But, you know, these shows like The Lion King, Wicked, Book of Mormon, they run forever. So if you got a new musical, you got nowhere to go.
Well, I don't know if it was from scratch, but where The Lion King first opened up on 42nd Street there, the name of the New Amsterdam Theater, they renovated that extensively.
That was a former Ziegfeld Show Palace. It was okay. Certainly not a new space from scratch. You know, that's defined as a theater that doesn't use some landmark stuff or things from an old theater that pre-existed. Even when they moved two theaters and combined them into one, that still constituted not from scratch. This is like a brand new Broadway house, never existed before. And that one, of course, The Lion King, that's where it started. And then it moved and made room for Mary Poppins, which ran a long time. Mary Poppins was one of the longest running hits in Broadway history. It closed. And now Aladdin's opened up. That's going to run a long time. And guess what? Lion King is still playing.
And playing and playing. And by the way, now that, of course, I've trounced all over King Kong, watch it go on to be like the world's greatest musical ever, and it'll play for 15, 20 years, and I'll be...
Well, the big thing there is it's just not ready, and they know it. They've completely fired everybody, started from scratch, practically. I mean, they've got the animatronics, or whatever you call it, for the Kong, the ape. That seems to be fine. But, you know, the book and the songs, not so good.
Could you imagine the director or the star of King Kong? You're firing me, but you're keeping the ape?
Duh.
Well, we were just talking about Rosie Perez. It's a big week for Rosie Perez.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. She'll be starring on Broadway, as we just mentioned, in a comedy, and appearing on The View as a permanent host. Perez joins Whoopi Goldberg and Rosie O'Donnell, along with newcomer Nicole Wallace. Yeah, we didn't know who Wallace was either, but given the political leanings of the other three, if you guessed she was a Republican player, you're right. With new producers and a new set and new gimmicks galore, this is not your mother's The View. Though it better appeal to your mother and you if they want to remain relevant thanks to the other female chat shows breathing down their neck. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. You know, you want to have good chemistry. They had a big Hunger Games style shootout among all the people who wanted to be on the show. There's a lot of money to be made. It's very visible and everybody wanted a part of it. So I think Nicole Wallace came through that process, but Rosie Perez was sort of a left field pick. She's been on the show, I think, once or twice, but I've seen her on Craig Ferguson and she's hilarious. I like her a lot. She's very appealing. She'll certainly bring an average Joe's perspective to the issues of the day. She's not exactly, you know, a nuclear physicist. I don't mean she's dumb. I just mean she's not reading the news all the time. So I think she's just going to react in a very, like, what's going on, you know, sort of way. So it'll be fun to see her on that show. Rosie O'Donnell looks geared up and ready to do more. Whoopi is a pro. So it'll be fun to see what happens. It's really hard to bring in new people. You know, Live with Regis did it. You had Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. Then you had Regis and Kelly. Now Regis is gone and it's Kelly and Michael, and they're doing great, but yeah, it ain't easy to do.
Well, now, have you ever interviewed Rosie Perez?
I don't think so.
She's a lot of fun, actually.
Oh, yeah, I've seen her on Craig. She's a lot of fun. Oh, and there was a little bit of news in the Variety story about Rosie O'Donnell. They intimated that ABC actually fired Sherry Shepherd and Jenny McCarthy because they made it sound like we're leaving too. If Barbara goes, we go. But in fact, it sounds like Variety's claiming that no, they decided to drop those two and start fresh.
Yeah, I never doubted that, actually.
Well, there you go.
This next story is really a lot of fun. Talk about Rosie Perez being fun. This next story is fun. Margaret Atwood is writing a new work of fiction. But no one, not any of her biggest fans, and not any of you listening to this podcast, not anyone alive today, will probably read it. She's one of the first to say yes to an art project called The Future Library. It's created by Scottish artist Katie Patterson, who has overseen the planting of 1,000 trees near Oslo. Now and every year until 2114, the project will invite a writer to contribute a text. Then, in 2114, the trees will be cut down to provide the paper to print each as works of art. And this is a quote from Margaret Atwood. She says, "What a pleasure," she was telling The Guardian. "You don't have to be around for the part when, if it's a good review, the publisher takes credit for it, and if it's a bad review, it's all your fault. And why would I believe them anyway? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?"
Well, it's very cool.
Yes.
I don't know if it's a big deal, but it's just fun, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's just great. I mean, unless the singularity comes along and we get to put our brains in a computer and live forever, we're literally not going to be around to read it.
I thought that my brain was just going to basically on Futurama, it was just going to be like a head in a jar.
Well, that's what we all hope for.
Right. Well, the new round of honorees for the Kennedy Center Awards have been announced. Few will object, since they're icons like actor Tom Hanks, singer Al Green, ballet dancer Patricia McBride, comedian Lily Tomlin, and Broadway wannabe and sometimes pop star Sting. They'll be feted by their peers, toasted by President and Michelle Obama, and get a really big medal they can sport on fancy occasions. Big deal or big whoop?
I gotta say big whoop, right? I mean, it's nice, it's pleasant, it's a fun evening, they're all worthy. I don't know who's not on there that should be, or who's been skipped over the years, or what group has been overlooked too often. But, you know, they're all certainly defensible people to claim as, you know, beloved national landmarks.
Exactly. Now, here's a question for you. How do you say "don't" in Mandarin? That's a question The Simpsons will have to answer, as one of the biggest shows in television history is finally coming to China. The 26th season of the animated series has made a deal with Sohu Video, one of the leading online video platforms in that market in China. The show will be screened with subtitles in Mandarin. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal, not because of The Simpsons, not because of the subtitling in Mandarin, which I think it's interesting they don't do dubbing, by the way.
Yeah, I was surprised too.
Yeah, but the idea of this over-the-top online video platform.
Yes.
That's a big deal in China too, isn't it? Everybody wants, that's the future of television. Forget your cable into your home. Forget Time Warner Cable. Sorry, guys. But it's over the top, isn't it? However, whoever, you know, breaks through and has enough channels together, that's what people are going to want.
Now, I know you're going to love this next story, Michael. In the unlikeliest signing since, well, I guess, Craig Ferguson, CBS has hired British actor James Corden to take over that late night talk show. He'll start early next year and follow Letterman and ultimately Stephen Colbert. Does Corden have a growing career that makes this left swing into American talk show surprising? Well, yes. He has a sketch comedy show focused on sports in the UK, an online series called The Wrong Mans, has a solid role in the Christmas musical Into the Woods.
That's a movie, I should say. Yeah.
And he gave up a starring role in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which is a Broadway show, to do this talk show. So is this crazy, crazy like a fox, or a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's surprising. I mean, ever since we heard it, we thought, really? How did they find him? How did they think of him? Here's the argument for it, because it's so puzzling. One is they've seen him do the Brit Awards. He's been a great host of award shows, and that sort of has the same skill set as a talk show host. You got to be quick on your feet. You got to respond to the moment. You got to be charming and amiable. And he's gotten great reviews over the last few years for hosting the Brits and other stuff like that. So he's clearly got the chops as far as that's concerned. This sketch comedy show is a hint that his show may not be a straightforward talk show. They're planning perhaps to do a lot more sketches than you would expect, and not just like Carson doing the great, what's he called?
The Great Karnak.
The Great Karnak, thank you. He sounded just like Ed McMahon there. And but, you know, actual sketches, I guess, timed to the day. So maybe there'll be more acting than you expect. And, you know, a lot of the stuff he's done, he's had to make happen himself. So if he does this, there's a huge amount of money. He'll be far more visible worldwide. I mean, we know him, but most people don't, to be honest. So it would make him a much bigger star than he is now. If he does it for 5 or 10 years, I mean, that's what you're talking about when you commit to a talk show. It just seems weird. I mean, he gave up this revival that was being built around him that was going to open on Broadway. That's not happening anymore. So clearly he was on the upswing, but he's, you know, decided a TV talk show is where he wants to go.
He wants it's to be weird, on TV every night, not just once in a while.
There's a lot of money. He can do everything he can do now, like sing. He can sing. He can do sketches. He can chat with guests. He can be charming and amiable. Clearly he can't do any projects on the side. He can't do a Broadway show. He can't do a movie. He can't do anything when you're doing a talk show. It's consuming you up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But it's a lot of money. He's 36. And while he's got a lot of heat and buzz, it's not like people are throwing, you know, feature films at his feet.
Well, you could get John Oliver to fill in for you.
That's right. He could. Yeah. So he starts in the spring. He'll be following Letterman, and then Colbert will take over. So he'll get those big bounces first from all the attention being paid to Letterman as he fades away or, you know, rides off into the sunset. And then the big burst of attention following Colbert's launch. So, you know, he's going to get sampled a lot.
You know, we just talked about The Simpsons, but what I want to know, Michael, is do you want to record every episode of The Simpsons ever made?
Yes.
Well, do you want to do it without filling up your DVR?
Impossible.
Actually, TiVo has the answer for you. The TiVo Mega. The monster of a DVR can hold 26,000 hours of programming in standard def. But who records standard def anymore anyway? Maybe your grandmother, but your grandmother is not the target audience for this device. That would be the high-end user, the sort who loves gadgets and loves their TV. Well, the TiVo Mega can record more than 4,000 hours of high-def programming before you have to, like, start deleting stuff. That's a lot of baseball, basketball, football, soccer, you know, like every World Cup game, in fact, for 10 years. So it's like 10 years worth or 10 World Cups worth or something like that. In other words, it's so much programming, you really don't have to worry about filling it up. You just have to worry about remembering what you have on it. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm not sure.
Well, I think it's a big whoop because it seems to be more of it's so high end. This is a rack mountable TiVo, which
and it costs like $5,000.
Yeah, it's meant to actually go into a like true
a
AV. Yeah, it's not for the, you know, it's for at home use if your home happens to have, you know, it costs like $20 million.
But it does raise the bar and raise the potential and say, hey, why are we so limited in our DVRs? Why do we constantly butt up against storage space when storage space is so cheap?
Yes, but, you know, that's because...
You can walk into a store and get a terabyte for $80 now, and it's tiny.
Yes.
You know, it's amazing. So, hey, why shouldn't we be able to record...
How old is your TiVo?
I don't have a TiVo.
Okay, well, my TiVo is about 5 years old. So part of the reason that, you know, we keep butting up against the storage limits is, A, I record way too much and don't watch enough of it, and B... You know, we keep our DVRs for quite some time. So, yes, today we can have more storage for less money, but our TiVos are from, you know, 5 years ago.
I love it when your DVR gets broken. Half the time when you replace it, they give you the same model.
Ugh, I know. I hate that.
They're like, oh, no, that's your model.
Yeah, well, how do you still have it is usually my question.
Yes, which brings us to our final story.
Actually, the FCC is taking a look at the definition of broadband, which naturally changes with the times. But AT&T and Verizon, through their industry spokespersons...
Well, they got a spokes... what do you call it? A collective, a group,
A trade group.
Yes.
Well, yeah. That whole trade group, that whole, you know, cabal, they're terrified. The current standard right now is 4 megabits per second downstream and 1 megabit per second up. I don't know what that was.
That was scoffing.
Ah, okay. Well, they say, and that is Verizon and AT&T and this trade group, they say that is plenty fast for most people. The FCC is considering changing the definition of broadband to 10 megabit per second downstream and some undetermined speed upstream. This is, of course, that would radically change the picture in terms of competition and how good a job internet providers are doing offering broadband to most Americans. In fact, the FCC says 10 megabit per second is probably way too slow, and 25 megabit per second is far more realistic. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it'll be a big deal when they change it and hopefully make it 25 megabits per second rather than 10 or 4, which is a joke. And yeah, they have to keep changing the bar, and you have to keep expanding, and then they have to upgrade to meet the new demand and meet the new standards that are set. If they're given their choice, they'll never upgrade.
Well, they would upgrade, but they'd only do it later so that they can charge more. Much like the new Apple Watch does not have a camera on it. Gee, I wonder why. Could it be because a year from now, in 2016, they're going to offer a new version of the Apple Watch 2,
because I wouldn't want a camera on an Apple Watch. That's stupid.
I'm just saying.
Where would you look to see what you were taking a picture of?
No, you know, like a FaceTime camera.
Oh, that's not a camera. You mean just to offer FaceTime on your phone calls?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So you could look at your watch like Dick Tracy.
Right. All right. Well, I'm sure they will at some point.
Exactly.
But anyway, no, I mean, this is like, of course, the industry is fighting it. All the internet providers are fighting it. But it goes back to The Simpsons, and it goes back to the DVR, and it goes back to what you watch and where. More and more TVs going over the top, more and more demand on your channel and your bandwidth and on what you can watch and where and how. And all they want to do is slow us down.
Right. And all I can say is, hey, guess what, Time Warner Cable, Verizon, you want to do these over the top services? Guess what you're going to need? You're going to need faster internet.
They understand it. They just want to squeeze out as much money as possible with as crappy service as possible. Utility, I say. Utility.
Yes, well, that would be a big deal if you could turn it into a utility.
Yes.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as promised, we're going to be speaking with Richard Verrier. He is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times who covers the nuts and bolts of the entertainment industry with a focus on production trends, labor, and the exhibition sector and visual effects. Richard wrote a front page story last week about the state of California's plan to triple tax subsidies for film and television productions to $330 million annually. That would make California competitive with many of the other states that are courting Hollywood productions at a time when there is an increasing debate over the value of film tax subsidies and tax breaks and whether they actually create new jobs or whether they just shift them to different locations. Richard, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
So what was the big takeaway? Are these tax subsidies working? It seems the state of California thinks so.
Well, I think it depends on your perspective. From California's point of view, these credits have been very effective at luring jobs away from California to other places like Louisiana, New York, and Georgia that have seen pretty dramatic job growth. And California feels that in order to compete and to keep its homegrown industry here in the state, that they needed to offer a more compelling tax credit program. Currently, the incentive is quite limited. It only covers low-budget film and returning cable shows. New network TV shows aren't covered, and large budget movies aren't covered. So the feeling was that the program was just too limited to be.
Right. So they've done a couple things that I think were very logical and made sense that few people would disagree with. One was to increase the amount of money they were offering and to get rid of the lottery system, because in the old days, it would just sort of be a random lottery to win one of these tax breaks. And now they're going to make it based on which project is offering the most jobs for the area and the best paying jobs. So it's not going to be just random. It's going to be based on some sort of logic about what good they're going to bring the California industry. And finally, of course, they're going to allow big budget movies and TV shows to take part. So I think that all makes sense. But as your article raises the question is, with these other states pulling money and jobs away from California, are they spending their money wisely? And that seems to be a lot less clear.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. While it may make sense for California to expand its credit and remove some of these restrictions, the question is whether, you know, it makes sense for other states to be offering such generous film incentives. And there is a long national debate about the value of these credits and whether they actually create new jobs or just shift from one place to another, create any net benefit.
Yeah, well, New York seems to be the one state that perhaps has the best argument for a success story. It already had a strong infrastructure, and certainly Governor Cuomo, who wants to run for president, would like to argue he's done a great job bringing business to New York City and state. He doesn't even include the mayor in when he gets to make an announcement about this show or that show coming to New York City or state. Is there an argument that the states with a stronger infrastructure and history of development and production of movies and TV shows can benefit more from offering these tax breaks as opposed to somewhere like Louisiana or North Carolina, where they're sort of starting from scratch?
Right. I think one of the concerns that critics point out with these programs is that states can invest a lot of resources into attracting the film and TV industry, helping to subsidize development of sound stages, for example. And then there can be a political change, and all of a sudden, a governor may express some skepticism of the film program, or there might be some debate about that. And then suddenly there's a shift, and Hollywood takes business elsewhere. And we've seen that play out in Michigan, which at one point was one of the hottest states in the country for the film industry. Everyone seemed to be flocking to Michigan, and there was a flood of production. Then they had a change of administration, and the new governor started to express some skepticism toward the value of film incentives. They scaled back their program pretty heavily, and as a result, production left Michigan, and some of the studios that were built, were left empty. So that's kind of a cautionary tale, and that has played out in other states to varying degrees. New Mexico is another case where there had been a change of administration, and the film program had been, cut back after the governor, expressed doubts about whether it was worth the investment.
Now, New Mexico is where Breaking Bad was shot, and, isn't there a tour where you can go to visit all of the Breaking Bad locations?
Yes, there is. And, New Mexico will point out that is a success story. And certainly, people do visit Albuquerque just to see the sites. And I think there's at least one tour offering fans, different sites that are depicted in the show.
But truly, tourism has to be the lamest justification for this tax break program in any state. I mean, 999 movies out of 1,000 are not going to increase tourism to your state. And if the other one does, it's just a fluke, like Field of Dreams and the baseball field or New Mexico. And it's a fad that will soon fade away.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I think in some places there has been a long-term tourism impact. I mean, you could certainly say that, people visit LA in part because of the allure of film sets, but they're coming here also for other reasons. I think even proponents wouldn't make the case that the justification for film credits is because of tourism, but there has been some benefit in some places, particularly well-known sites like with popular shows like Breaking Bad. New Zealand had a thriving tourism business around The Hobbit, but I think that's really of secondary importance.
Well, and I guess what confuses me, and it doesn't confuse me so much as I can understand why people would be upset about this, is why are some of these productions and some of these producers, they get the tax credit in, say, Georgia, and then they go and sell it?
Yes, there are at least a dozen states, actually I think a few more, that allow states to sell the credits. The argument is a lot of these companies don't have a tax liability in the state where they get the credit. So they can either get a refund from the state, or what some states allow, like Georgia, is they allow them to sell them to third parties. And what has happened is that there's this growing secondary market now for film tax credits, just like energy credits, and companies that buy them typically have no connection to the film industry. We did a story last year that looked at this and found that some of the buyers were companies like Walmart and Bank of America. So they buy the credits at a discount and then use them to lower their own taxes in different states. The proponents in these states will say that everyone benefits because these companies, the companies that buy the credits, they get a reduction on their taxes. It's good for the film companies because they get to, sell a liability to another company, even if they don't own any taxes in that state. But, there has been criticism of these types of programs because the ultimate beneficiaries are companies that they have nothing to do with the film industry.
And of course, the MPA loves it when these states compete with each other to offer tax breaks to Hollywood. That's why Chris Dodd is having his annual Film Commissioner Summit in D.C. on September 29th, where they invite all the people from the different states to come. And hey, let's keep doing this. It's a great idea. But is Hollywood playing all these different states for suckers? You know, moving your business from one place to another, whoever's got the prettiest offer this week, that's where you go. And next week, you'll go somewhere else.
Well, you know, it's ultimately their, you know, they're a lobbying group for the major studios, and it's their job to try to get, you know, the best deal they can. And so, you know, they maintained that this conference was planned well ahead of what California did. I think, you know, the timing is a little awkward for them. But, you know, from their standpoint, they say that these credits basically help keep production in the U.S. as opposed to going to Canada. So from that standpoint, they're beneficial. But there's no question that studios benefit when there are, you know, multiple states that they can pick and choose from and say, well, you know, if you don't want to give us the best deal we want, then we'll take it to another state. And, you know, we've seen them use that kind of leverage on certain shows.
Well, it used to be that, you know, runaway production did mean that production was going to Canada. So I guess I have a kind of a two-part question here. Are these subsidies actually bringing production back to the United States, if not California? And is technology or the ability to make television shows and to produce movies on much bigger scales for lower budgets, is that actually aiding in this runaway production from Los Angeles?
Well, that's an interesting point. I think technology is a factor, although it cuts both ways, because with green screen technology now, you can film something, you know, you can film a show that's set in Czechoslovakia and film it right here in LA, because you can just, you know, put in your green screen background. Huh. But the same technology, it makes it easier to shoot, you know, a story that's set in LA anywhere else. You know, Canada is still a big rival. I mean, there's a lot of production that happens in Toronto and Vancouver, and it kind of ebbs and flows depending on the exchange rates. You know, when the Canadian dollar was really cheap, it was just that much, you know, companies could get that much better deal filming north of the border. Now that the dollar is closer in value, you know, they're pretty much the same, that, you know, there's less of an incentive to go to Canada, but they're still pretty competitive. I think it's fair to say that a lot of the production that has shifted to places like Louisiana and Georgia, New York, that they've diverted some of that production from Vancouver and Toronto and other places. So there's some truth to the idea that these credits have kept more production in the U.S.
Well, from what was just a few million dollars a decade ago, states now pay out about $1.5 billion in film incentives every single year. And we thank Richard Verrier for being here from the Los Angeles Times to tell us all about it. Is there someplace that our listeners can go to read your work or follow you?
Yeah, feel free to follow us at latimes.com or on Twitter. And thanks for having me.
Okay, well, the Twitter account to follow is at rverrier. We'll place a link to that in the show notes. And Richard, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, that was nice of Richard to stop by and talk to us about that. It's, you know, the article's got a lot of hard data about, you know, for every dollar you spend, how much money is the state actually pulling in? It's an interesting article. People should check it out.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the state of Massachusetts, now it depends on who you ask, of course. They say, you know, somebody did a study where they got back only 13 cents in revenue for every dollar spent in tax credits. So I think, you know.
So they lost 87 cents on every dollar they spent?
Yeah, and you know, there was something like $12,000 in the state of Louisiana was spent in tax credits for every single job that they made. So it was $12,000 per job, effectively, they were spending. I don't know. Again, you know, statistics can tell you anything you want, depending on how you put them together.
No, but I have no doubt that the more states keep competing against each other to lure jobs to their state, you see it in all sorts of other businesses, trying to get an auto business, you know, a car factory, trying to get
Tesla.
What's it called? Tesla and their battery factory. Everybody was offering their firstborn child to Tesla to try to get them to come to their state. At some point, you know, it can't be worth the money you're offering. At some point, it's got to be a loss.
I just offered my firstborn child so that I could get a Tesla.
Get a Tesla. Yeah. Forget the Gigafactory or whatever that gets called. But there you go. So that's Inside Baseball. It moves us on into Obits, where we talk about two people. One very well-known, one not so well-known. The first is director Andrew V. McLaughlin.
Yes, he was the son of Oscar winner Victor McLaughlin, who directed...
Great, great actor. Opposite John Wayne and a bunch of people in lots of movies. You know, you'd recognize him if you saw him.
And so he passed away. And now, of course, we had to have to touch on Joan Rivers.
Oh, well, you know, but just to explain to Andrew McLaughlin, he's not just the son of Victor McLaughlin. He directed John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart in a bunch of movies. But his big work was he did like over 100 episodes of Gunsmoke. And the entire run of the TV show Have Gun, Will Travel. So a lot of Westerns on his thing. Hollywood, Scion, you know, a son of a famous actor, an Oscar winner, I think, wasn't he? And what I loved was in reading his obit that he was on the set of Gunga Din as a kid just out of high school. That must have been a blast.
Yes.
Yeah, you can imagine that. But yeah, Joan Rivers, of course, is the big news.
Yes, she, of course, a legendary stand-up comic. I called her a trailblazer on Twitter. I think that we could say that she broke new ground. She was a trailblazer. She was the first female late-night talk show host, right?
Absolutely.
I don't know. I mean, I think everybody... What I found interesting about her passing was that for years, everybody's been using her as a punching bag because she did the whole red carpet thing where she made fun of people on the red carpet. And she passes away and everybody only has good things to say about her, as if, like, all this time they've you know, she was...
They loved when she was teasing them. I was a little surprised by the warmth, too, on Broadway. You know, she appeared in three shows, and she got a Tony nomination for one of them. But I don't really think of her as a Broadway baby as such, though I know she liked Broadway. And apparently she's been championing. She's got a lot of friends because they went up before the league and said, oh, should we dim the lights for her? And their ruling was, well, she doesn't quite seem Broadway enough. You know, we like her. Of course, it's not an insult, but you want to save her for people who are truly Broadway, you know, people. And they decided not to. And there was a big outcry. And five theaters said, well, we're going to dim our lights anyway. And an online petition started and they changed their mind. Said, all right, we love her too. Fine, we'll dim the lights for Joan Rivers. So they're going to do that. They're going to dim the lights for a minute for Joan Rivers on Broadway. And there's been a real outpouring of affection. Chris Rock, who's in Toronto, he just sold his third film for a good sum, and he's on a career high as far as personal achievement. And he had a lot of great things to say about Joan Rivers. He said, forget that she's a great female comic. He said, she's just a great comic. And she's cool and hip right up until she's dying and 80 plus years old. He said he sees a lot of comics in their 40s and 50s recycling jokes about Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton. He's like, she was always on top of the game.
She was making jokes about Lindsay Lohan.
Exactly. That was sort of his joke. And, you know, it's true. I mean, she's reinvented herself so many times. You know, she was a reality TV star, a fashion critic, a plastic surgery. You know, she brought herself back from the dead by going on the Hollywood Squares and doing the Center Square, which I totally forgot about.
Yeah, I forgot about that too, actually.
And she forgot about her lifelong feud with Johnny Carson, which is, you know, one of the real sore points in her life. You know, he meant so much to her, and she betrayed him by doing her own late-night talk show, and he never spoke to her again.
Yeah, if you want a really good version of that story, listen to her tell that story in, I cannot remember the name of the film, A Piece of Work. A Piece of Work is the name of the documentary. And she tells the story of when she decided to sign with Fox, a fledgling new network, and do a late night talk show opposite Johnny Carson. Johnny Carson had hired her as the permanent guest host, so there would never be any reruns. She, you know, Joan Rivers would step up and fill Johnny Carson's shoes for a week or two.
She was on The Tonight Show even before Johnny Carson, but he really made her career.
Yes, and he was so upset about that, he basically never talked to her again. And that phone call that she received from Johnny Carson,
she called him and he hung up on her. And then she called him again and he hung up on her again.
And they've never talked again. Ever.
But then he died. But that's actually not the whole story, because more info came out. His longtime producer finally published his memoir, and it turned out that her husband, who committed suicide after her talk show flopped, lied to her, at least according to this guy, when he said that he called Johnny's people and let them know about the offer. He apparently never did. I mean, Johnny's producer had no reason to lie about it. He had no animus towards her or Edgar. It was so long ago. And he's like, no, they never called. So it came out of total left field. And that's one reason why they were so angry. And of course, she never should have accepted anyway without going to Johnny and saying, what do you want me to do? I'll wash your floors. I won't take the offer if you don't want me to. I mean, she was the de facto next head of The Tonight Show if she just bided her time. But oh well,
yeah.
You know, that's a sad part of her life. Her husband committing suicide. She had a lot of, you know, punches against her, and she came back strong every time. She always reinvented herself. She was pretty darn funny right up until the end.
And you know what? She was just naturally funny. I mean, she would literally go, she, in this movie, A Piece of Work, which is really worth watching, she was playing some you know, some casino somewhere, some, you know, small town Michigan show. And she, of course, was talking about, you know, why do I have to do all these shows in the middle of nowhere? Why am I doing this? Why do I need the money so badly? It's also when she did the Comedy Central roast for the money, she goes in and there's like a craft service table. And so she's like, oh, look, they have, you know, food and oh, look, they even have wine. And she lifts up the bottle of wine and she looks at the camera and goes, it says May. So the wine was from May. That is well worth watching. And I had a friend who said, I can't believe Joan Rivers was going to get, she had some procedure done that was kind of elective.
A throat surgery procedure, yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of elective just to see why her voice was scratchy. And she was saying, oh, I would not have, does she not remember the law of threes? If Robin Williams had died and Lauren Bacall had died, I wouldn't have left the house until I heard Mariah Carey had choked on a butterfly.
Okay. And of course, the NYPD is investigating her death because it was not by natural causes, but that's standard operating procedure. There's no implication yet that anything was shoddy or untoward about that. As far as a dumb headline, I think the dumbest headline I saw was the book sales for Joan Rivers spike 70,000%.
Yeah, well, that doesn't
yes,
shock
well,
me.
Well, when you have no book sales and then you die, and your sales start to go up. Yes, they do spike a huge percentage. But like, how many copies did she actually sell? You know, that's a dumb headline from the Hollywood Reporter. Oh, well, can we talk? Can she talk? Can we talk? We can talk and talk and talk. And that's why it's time to say goodbye.
That's true, in fact. And it is time to say goodbye. I'd like to thank Richard Verrier from the Los Angeles Times for joining us to talk about film tax incentives. Although I guess you could also call them television tax incentives since it's for film or television productions. Now, we want to let you know you can subscribe in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, any place.
So when you're getting your U2 album, why not, you know, subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox and write a review while you're at it.
Yes, writing reviews actually does help us out, especially with iTunes and the Microsoft Marketplace. They do look at them when they're picking those podcasts to promote. They look at the reviews, so it does help us out. We'll place links to ways to subscribe to us, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to contact us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, I didn't mention that you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Michael Giltz has his own website. Michael, what is it?
Apple Michael.
Apple Michael, of course, applemichael.com. Okay, well,
iMichael is so 2013.
That's true. I guess Apple did change their branding from i to Apple, whatever it is, whatever the product is. Yeah, well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry,
I bet Apple Michael's available.
I bet you it is. You should probably go and reserve it immediately. Well, you can try and find some of his work on the Huffington Post, or michaelgiltz.com is another great place to try, or bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.